I know it says that I'm sharing sound, but hopefully, if things work out, I can play this little chant at the end here. Towards the end, as part of the talk, but we'll see if that works out. So, I really am glad that I co-teach with Tim. I was thinking over the week, I was thinking about Rodney, and if some emergency came up for him, he would have been stuck because it was him pretty much. And so I'm grateful for Tim. But I think what happened was perfect. And I think it's all part of Dhamma. And I want to explain that. It's perfect for where we are. And I think it's going to be a great way to articulate exactly what it is that we're talking about. Because we're practicing this whole year with everyday Dhamma. And everyday Dhamma means everyday life. It just means our everyday stuff happens, life happens, rehab facilities, or somebody's living down in the basement, or having a steel rod as a leg. It's like, this is just everyday life. This is what this is. And you may be thinking to yourself, you know, because, you know, I like to start every month with contemplation. Let's just contemplate the nature of death and then get into the practices towards the end of the month. But I could see where you could think, oh, we should just do the practices. Well, what's the contemplation on death? That could feel a little bit more morbid than just practicing. But what I have found is that we don't use our practices in the midst of drama, disasters, difficulties, struggles, unless we have contemplated the nature of it. And there's an understanding that we get aligned with beforehand. So Ajahn Sumedho and Philip followed him in his book, Dancing with Life, basically said that the practice is divided up into three parts. The first part is to take the concept of that Dhamma and incorporate it. See how it feels. How does it land for you? Do you believe it? Do you even trust it? I mean, is it real? Or is it just some pretend theory, something else we've learned in another book I've put on my shelf? Maybe I'll read it, maybe I won't. Who knows? But in Dhamma, contemplation is extremely important so that you are aligned with what you believe. And then you practice. When you get aligned with what you believe, then you practice with it and see if it holds true. Is it real? Is this really the way it is? And then when you've contemplated it and you've practiced with it, then you can begin to see it show up at given moments and you know it to be real. Not because some teacher told you, but because you know it's real, because you've lived it. You know it for your own self. It's the whole point around come see for yourself. So I said last week, I mean, on that first talk, that we can't even talk about everyday Dhamma without having a month on death. That at its core, death is the Buddha Dhamma. That the Buddha Dhamma is intersected with death. It's at the heart of Buddha Dhamma. So do you believe that? Is that something you say? I say it from my core, from my gut here. What about you? Do you say that? Do you believe that? Is death at the core of it? Or is that something we hear and we try to practice that, but we don't really believe it? So one way I was saying that we could look at this as a core, death being the core of Dhamma, is to look at impermanence, to look at loss, and to look at the death of the body. And that those, that way of looking at it is how we began to see the truth of death all around us. And it's not so much that you want to know, can you resuscitate what the meaning of death is in the Buddhist psychology, as much as it is, how can death be known in this moment? How can I know it? If death is something I believe is at the heart of Dhamma, and death is inherent in my everyday life, then how can I know it in this moment? Does somebody have to die? Is that the only way I'm going to know it? And at the moment someone dies, someone close to me, can we even grab the practice to practice with it? When Mama died, practice was a long ways from me. I was going to have to wait a bit before I caught up with the practice. I was off in a panic. Because it's when these things happen to us, we get so caught in the everyday life of it that practice isn't always something that's just sitting on the shelf that I can just pull down. Unless we contemplate with it, unless we contemplate it, let it marinate within us till it becomes a part of us and we breathe it and see it throughout our days. That's what we're doing when we think about death. So today we're going to talk about practicing with it, but I want to first use the example of what happened last week, because this is what I think is at the heart of what I'm trying to point to. So I talked to my son. You know, my son is white, so I did not give birth to him. This is true. He does have a birth mama, but he is definitely my son. I know it. I knew it. I knew we had a mother-son relationship within a couple of times seeing him. And it's been that way ever since. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, he's my son. And that's just the end of it. So it's important that you know he's my son, because we do things for family that we don't necessarily do for strangers or even friends. We can have close friends, but there's a limit to what we would do. But family, for some reason, takes us outside of our comfort zone. We're willing to go much further. So I talked to him and said, I'm gonna tell people about this today. And he was fine with that. So that's why I'm telling you. So he is in the food industry, and he was doing really pretty good financially until COVID hit. And when COVID hit, you know, the food industry got smacked, and it was difficult. But, you know, he has really good optimism, and him and his fiance, they're living in a really nice house, and they're really feeling kind of good. They can make it. They got savings. And it's just dwindling away and dwindling away and dwindling away. It's like this is impermanence in reality. He had nothing to do with COVID coming. But when COVID hit, it took a while for the reality of what was going to happen with him to catch up with his mind. Because for a long time, he's just living like he's always lived, even though COVID is this undercurrent. And then after a year of it, you know, he just doesn't have any money. He's not making any money, and no money's coming in, and savings is going down, 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 down. So first he's panicking about this huge mortgage payment that's due every month. So I said, well, maybe you should talk to the bank about like a forbearance kind of during COVID. You can put the mortgage on the back end of the note. And he worked it out, talked and worked out, going smooth. Kind of refresh the soul. I can do it, he's thinking. But then the forbearance ends at the end of this month. And he is in the same position he was in like 6 months ago when we first talked about this forbearance. Nothing has really changed. And so the reality that he has this huge mortgage payment coming up just got unbearable for all of us. So then we talked about, what about if you sell the house? They have some really good equity in it. And so this realtor came and talked to him. And next thing I know, he's calling me and telling me, we got 30 days. We got to get out because the mortgage is due at the end of the month. And we got 30 days. Can you help me? Can you come and pack? Can you help me this? Can you help me that? So I'm like, okay. This is crazy month. But okay, I can squeeze it in. I can fit this in with that. Put this over there, move a little bit of this and rearrange that, and we could do it. But the pressure of packing up your stuff, deciding what you keep and what you don't keep, what you can take to a storage and what you can't take to a storage, this pressure of 30 days paring your life down. This is what loss is. I'm hoping you can see that COVID, there was a death that happened in COVID when he lost his income and things began to change. And then in the midst of this having to move out, there is a loss that is occurring. But no one is connecting to the loss, the nature of loss, or the nature of impermanence. Everybody's just running. They're just trying to get the house packed up, get the things done, put this done. This work has got to be done. So by the weekend, Sunday, we had spent days packing things up. By Sunday, the level of anger and panic that was in the house was over the top. And every time I would come around, they would be all nice. They would be all friendly with each other. Like, oh no, you put that over there. No, I think you should do that. It was all nice and nice whenever I was around. I'm like, okay, you guys, keep it steady. It's not anybody's doing here. You can see this. It's not him. It's not her. It's not anything they've done. It is the nature of life that things can shift abruptly. And your whole world is topsy-turvy. You didn't do that. But because it has happened, it is natural to feel tension, anger, you're worried, you're disappointed. All of this energy is there. Our practice is to keep us careful not to dump all that on somebody else. And so by the time the talk started, I'm like, okay, now I'm going to go do this talk. Can you guys hold it together? They're like, yes, we're okay. We're fine. Thank you. We're good. I don't even know if you guys could hear how much yelling was going on. But there was an incredible amount of yelling going on right in the room next to me. So there was all this tension ahead. And so I text him and said, I just don't think this is going to work out. I got a feeling that this is not going to be held together. So can you cover? But Tim didn't get the message until the meditation. And in the meditation is when he texted me and said, I can do it if you still want me to. So I get off the screen and I work it out with him and tell him what I covered. And then I go and I come out of the room. Tim is covering. And they're both looking at me saying, what are you doing here? I said, somebody else is going to cover. Man, you guys are screaming and yelling at each other. I can't teach Dhamma like that. And they're just both looking at me like, they're so sorry. Like, how did it get to this? What happened? How did we get to this? It was so good. We were okay. And now everything is crumbling. What happened? And I realized that the people that needed the summary of impermanence and loss and understanding that in relation to Dhamma was them. That you needed the summary, but Tim could cover that. And I needed to give them the summary I was going to give you. So that's what I did. I gave them, I said, that's it. You got to listen to my talk. Sit down. Listen to my talk. Let's work through it. But by the time I was finished, I think they were clear. This is impermanence. It is difficult. It is problematic. COVID reeks with impermanence. It's all around us. And there's all this tension. I mean, I think we're going to have psychological, health-related, mental health issues around what it was like to live through COVID. Because it's a little different. We live through COVID. I mean, there is an advantage because we could talk to each other on Zoom and we could connect each other. We can do all these things. Very different than 1918. Got a vaccine in like, I don't know, less than 2 years. It's very different than 1918. But the pressure of what has happened, the disruption, the knowing of other people's disruption. So even if I'm trying to hold my life together, everybody around me, something terrible is going on with them, and that's scaring me even more. So I'm holding on even more. There's all this loss, and we are all trying to hold on so we don't have the inevitable, which is loss and impermanence. But that is why we are practicing. Not so life is easy and smooth and you're mountain bike riding up in the whatever she called that area. It's not that. You're not like off doing some luxury thing. It just means I can be steady. I can understand that I'm gonna lose it if I'm losing everything in a month's time. But I can find my center, apologize, regroup, reconnect, and still stay afloat, still stay with the place of where I want to be. You see what I'm saying? This is why we're contemplating this, so we can see the difference between something I'm doing and the nature of life itself. That's what this is. So I want to turn and look at some practices, right? So we can contemplate. I think this week has been quite different, much less tension. I get all these little happy faces, little emojis that are happy and smiling and little hearts coming now. First, I was getting like, you know, Mama, can you do this? Can you help us with this? What can we do about this? Yelling at each other. His fiance would call me and say, it's all his fault. And he would call me and say, it's all her fault. But now it's happy faces. He still has to get out at the end of the month. It's still a loss, and it's still impermanent. But the only thing that's changed is that the relationship with it puts it in proper perspective. which is, this is life. Things like this happen. And we, our lives get topsy-turvy and we adjust and live into the new existence because conditions have changed. And they'll be fine. It's learning to contemplate your thoughts on this and practice with it to see if it's true. And then when some crazy thing happens, your practice becomes a part of who you already are. And you don't have to try to pull some practice off the shelf like you pull a Band-Aid and put it on a cut, or, oh, I have a headache, let me go get some aspirins and take that, and then that's going to deal with the headache. Dhamma is a little bit slower than that. It's more like, you probably haven't seen Zootopia, but in case you have seen Zootopia, the person working at the DMV is a sloth. So of course, they are so incredibly slow. Anyway, you have to see it to believe it. But one of the characters in the movie, it's a little cartoon kid movie, he's a fox. And the cop that's with him is a bunny rabbit. So bunny rabbits go fast, 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 fast. So he tells this sloth a joke. It takes forever for the sloth just to get to the point of laughing. Anyway, it's cute. That's more the way Dhamma is. It takes forever for the Dhamma to maneuver. It's like what Obama used to say, you're turning a big ocean liner. It takes some time for the Dhamma to turn into life. So if we're practicing to grab something off the shelf in a moment of, you know, unexpected impermanence or loss, it's not so accessible like that. But if we contemplate it, played it as part of life and begin to consider into it, then we can have access to it at a different rate. So there are five practices that I want to talk about. Four of them I'm going to talk about tonight, but one of them is this death meditation that I think Venerable Anaglio does a really good job, and we're going to talk about it through his work, but that really requires its own conversation. So next week I'm going to talk about Venerable Anaglio's death meditation. So I want to talk about three of them. I'm going to start with what I call sitting in the bones with grief. So Philip always says sitting in the bones. But one thing that comes with impermanence and loss is grief. You can feel the grief that they were feeling. Even though it comes out like they're yelling at each other, what's really at the yelling is grief. This losing my stability. I didn't expect to be here at the end of March. I didn't expect that I'm going to be trying to leave out of the house. So somewhere in April, my whole world shifted. That grief is something we have a hard time connecting with. So learning to contemplate the reality of death is what helps us open the door to practice with grief. Because you can't think about death without recognizing grief comes with it. So sitting in the bones with grief is what I think of it, contemplate it as. The way this practice is, it's sort of like in your meditation. So these are all meditative practices. I do these, all of them. and the way I sit in the bones with grief is I find this place of stillness and steadiness, place of groundedness. You have to be grounded in the earth, because grief, Rodney one time said that reality plus your resistance equals grief. So as long as we resist reality, the more resistance we have, I guess he said times your resistance, reality times your resistance equals grief. So the more resistance you have to reality, the more grief you have. And it doesn't mean, grief doesn't mean that we're going to walk around sad and cry. That's why some people experience grief. But what was in the house was grief last week, even though it was showing up like rage, blame, anger. But that's grief. That's what it is. So sitting in the bones with it means finding a way to settle yourself, connect to the breath. You're letting the world go for a moment. You can pick it back up. It's not going anywhere, but for a moment, for just a little while, I just want to be here with the breath. And the mind is going to be thinking, and you're going to drop it, let it go, let it go, let it go. And when you get settled, so I'm just right here, I'm just going to be right here, right now. I like what Philip does. I am arriving here now and being available for an experience. I'm practicing with grief, so I'm available to it. Recall a loss. Recall the loss of a parent, a friend. Recall the loss of your house, your job. It doesn't matter how long ago it was. If it was a loss, you can feel that grief. And once you recall it and you begin to feel the pain of it, you might feel anger. You might not feel sad, but that doesn't mean it's not grief. You might feel disappointment. You might feel anxiety. You just keep coming back to the ground. Once you begin to feel that emotional churning, let go of the story, because it really isn't about the story. The story was just to get you to bring the grief to the belly, bring the grief to the body, and then sit there with it. Notice it, investigate it. Where is it? Is it hard? I like to use elements, because elements are what I would consider objective rather than subjective, and I can connect with it easier. So is this hot, this feeling I'm feeling? Is it heavy? There are several earthy type things, hard or soft, rough or smooth, heavy or light. These are qualities of earth. So you just sit with this felt sense experience and begin to investigate. Is it fire? Fire is cool. Fire is hot. So is it cool? Is it warm? Is it hot? What's the intensity level of this feeling? And is that intensity everywhere in the body? Some places it might be cool. Some places it might be hot. There's a tightness in the belly whenever I have anxiety. It's so tight. And yet my toes are fine. I have seen it. I figured it out. The toes are doing good. They don't have any problems. They're like wiggling and everything's good. But my stomach is killing me. You want to see where it's at and get to know it more as a felt experience. And then I always carry a little mantra with me. This is the felt sense of loss. This is the felt sense of impermanence. This is the felt sense of grief. Or I asked rhetorical questions. How can grief be known? How can loss be known? How can impermanence be known? And if you find yourself constantly going back to the story behind all this feeling, see if you can send the story to the background and bring the feeling in the body to the foreground. Feeling in the body in the foreground, story in the background. It doesn't have to go away, but you just want it in the back. Like having the radio on in the back, but you're not really listening to it. Do they have radio still? Maybe having your computer on, the TV going in the back, but you're not listening to it. I feel like an old woman talking about a radio. Some of you know what I mean, though. So that's how you kind of sit in the bones with grief. You want to sit in the bones with it. And we do it as a practice and intentionally call it in so that we can sit for a duration of time. Like, I'm going to sit with this for 10 minutes. Just see. It's like a scientist. You're investigating it, understanding it. Don't start with the hardest grief you have. Pick something easy. Something softer, something more like a two. And the more you get comfortable with the discomfort of loss and impermanence, the more tougher that can be. But I have another way of working with loss, grief, this kind of death, impermanence, that might also work for you. This one I would call, it's a modified Tonglen. I don't know Tonglen itself, so this is my Tonglen. It is, so Tonglen is a Tibetan practice where you are basically breathing in the pain of another and breathing out goodness. It's like you're breathing in another's pain, and in your practice, you are transforming it and breathing out love. That's basically what you're doing. You're breathing in the pain of another, breathing out love. Pema Chodron, she breathes in darkness and breathes out light. I don't like that. It always makes it look like dark is bad, light is good. So I don't like that. What I do instead is breathe in the worldly winds. So I breathe in pain, or I breathe in loss. Just breathe it in. Just in the in-breath, I'm thinking of nothing but loss and the pain of loss. And then hold it there for a minute, like loss. I can hold this. I can be with this. And then I, like, put kindness with it, right? So I'm breathing this loss in, but I'm holding it with kindness, like metta. Soft, easy. Breathe in, loss. And then I don't say breathe out. I say let go of gain. So you breathe in the loss, you let go of the gain. Breathe in the loss. Always going to have loss. It's always going to come with the X, the inhale, and then we let go of the gain. Let it go. Gain comes, let it go. Breathe in, the worldly winds are, that is gain and loss, so you're breathing in the loss and you're letting go of the gain. Or it's pain and pleasure, so you're breathing in the pain, breathing it in, breathing it in, breathing it in, and you're letting go of pleasure, letting go of pleasure. You hold it in metta. You hold it, well, I guess you'd call it compassion. So you're holding it in this friendly softness, and then you're letting out the pleasure. Or you're breathing in blame, 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 blame. I can't believe they said that about me. Breathing it in, holding it with metta, and breathing out praise. Breathing it out. Letting go of praise. Letting go of praise. I'm taking in the blame. Letting go, taking it in. And the last one is fame or ill repute. So fame is, this is really in relation to your friends, family, coworkers. Fame, everybody likes me. You breathe in that nobody likes me. Everybody's mad at me. I can't seem to get it right. And then you breathe, let go, breathe out, get rid of fame. Everybody likes me. Everybody wants, I'm perfect. I'm beautiful. Everybody loves me. Let that go. That's what you're doing. You're just breathing it in, breathing it out, breathing it in, breathing it out, breathing it in, breathing it out. Just this constant flow. And you can begin to see, again, you've grounded yourself, so you begin to see there's always going to be an in-breath of some difficulty, some loss, some pain, some ill repute, some blame. It's always going to be breathing that in, and there's always going to be letting go, some pleasure. Just let it go. It comes and goes. It's like you can feel the pleasure and let that go. The softness of metta can help you feel the pleasure. Even the desire for pleasure when you're breathing in pain, and then you let it go. So that process of in and out and in and out and in and out is a way of helping us see how fluid life is. We got to know life is fluid, moving, changing in reality. It's not solid. It never has been. But in reality, we got to know its fluidity. Now, this last one is the one I want to play this chant with. Those two I just told you, those are ones I used to do for a long time, but now I have a new one. So I always change it up so that I don't get too, you know, I just love ritual. We're going to talk about ritual the next time I come, and I cannot wait. But I love ritual because I need something to help me stay connected to it. So I'd like to end with this chant. It is only 3 minutes, 2 minutes, I think. I'm going to use, I don't know if you guys have heard it, but Kittasaro and Tanesara, they do a lot of chanting, and this is one of their chants. And I'm going to read to you what I say. So I want us to get in a comfortable position so we can be like we're going to practice here for a minute. First, let me just make sure you can hear the chant. Let's see if you can hear it. You hear that? All right, we're cooking. Okay, let's turn it down a little bit because we don't want it that loud. We want it in the background. All right. So I learned what we're going to chant. We're going to use this chant to practice with the five recollections. Because the five recollections are another way of beginning to see the true nature of impermanence, death, and loss. But I also attach what are called the four awarenesses, or the Tibetans call them preliminaries, I guess. But there are four ways to me that we get our minds in a place to begin to grapple with the truth of impermanence. our level of fragility is so difficult to bear that we have a hard time with impermanence. And so the first group of sayings are to help us get our sense of wisdom around the reality of the world we live in, who we are as human beings. And then the second part is the five remembrances. Now, this chant is only 2 minutes, so it's not like this is going to be some long, drawn-out thing. But I've timed it so that I could say each of the little paragraphs just in line with this chant. And what the chant is, Namo Ban Shir Shir, Namo Ban Shir Shir, Ja, Namo Moni Fo, something like that. Anyway, it means it's paying homage to the Buddha as a man who kept himself together and went all the way to enlightenment. So it's not the Buddha after he was enlightened. It's the Buddha as a man who kept himself steady and stayed with his search for enlightenment all the way to the end. All right? So I am going to say this over the top. That's why I don't want it too loud. And we'll see. And if you like it, then I can help you do it. Send you the cards. Let's see. Okay. Maintaining an awareness of the preciousness of human life. And the particular good fortune of life in an environment in which you can hear the teaching of the Buddha Dhamma. Maintain an awareness of the reality of death, that it comes suddenly and without warning. Maintain an awareness of the entrapment of karma, and whatever you do, whether virtuous or not, further entrapped. Maintain an awareness of the intensity and inevitability of suffering for yourself and for all such beings. That attitude is a base. Call upon your teachers, devotion, inviting into yourself an atmosphere of sanity inspired by their example, vowing to cut off the roots of further ignorance. I am of the nature to get sick. Nothing and no one can change that. I am of the nature to grow old. Nothing and no one can change that. I am of the nature to die. That effect, I shall be the heir. So, what I do is I pick these phrases, and then I picked a chant, and I put them together. So when I hear that chant, I think of these phrases. When I hear these phrases, I think of that chant. And somehow by tying it together, I created this place for me where it is a way of understanding the five remembrances as a reality in life and not just something I read by rote. I feel it. I can feel the chant. I can feel it. I'm not used to saying it out loud. I'm usually saying it, reading it in my head, but I can feel it in the body. Something about the way Kitasaro sounds, it reminds me of what it takes to be able to stay with this practice all the way to the end. And that means we're going to lose it. We're going to get mad and yell at people. We're going to do all kinds of things because we are going to forever feel impermanence. Whether we want to or not, we are going to forever feel loss. We're going to forever feel the pressure of this life, this human birth. And at the same time, because we're human, this is the life that allows us to get enlightened. That from my understanding of Buddhist psychology, it's only the humans, it's only us, that can be enlightened. All the people in the heavenly realms or ghostly realms or whatever realms they're in, it's here in this human existence that enlightenment becomes possible. So I thought I would end with the poem that I was trying to read Pablo Neruda Horses last week. He says, "From the window I saw the horses. I was in Berlin in winter. The light was without light. The sky skyless. The air white like a moistened loaf. From my window, I could see a deserted arena, a circle bitten out by the teeth of winter. All at once, led out by a single man, 10 horses were stepping into the snow. Scarcely had they rippled into existence like flame than they filled the whole world of my eyes, empty till now. Faultless, flaming, they stepped like 10 gods on broad, clean hoofs, their manes recoiling, a dream of salt spray. Their rumps were globes, were orange. Their color was amber and honey, was on fire. Their necks were towers carved from the stone of pride. And in their furious eyes, sheer energy showed itself, a prisoner inside them. And there, in the silence, at the midpoint of the day, in a dirty, disgruntled winter, the horse's intense presence was blood, was rhythm, was the beckoning light of all being. I saw, and seeing, I came to life. There was the unwitting fountain, the dance of gold, the sky, the fire that sprang to life in beautiful things. I have obliterated that gloomy Berlin winter. I shall not forget the light from those horses." That's what's possible when we learn to let impermanence, death, and loss be known. So let's sit for a moment here. thank you so much for your kind attention. So, let's see if there's any questions or comments, really. Yeah, Carla.
Yeah, my question is around your personal Tonglen type practice. I thought that was really, really fascinating the way you do it. I haven't practiced much with Tonglen, but I think I understand the basic instructions like you recapped. So what I noticed, or what my impression was, how your version is different is in the traditional Tonglen, you're relating to others' suffering, right? You're breathing in the suffering of the world, and then you're giving out compassion or loving kindness. So in a way, it's almost something you're doing for the world or for others, perhaps even more than for yourself. But of course, having like creating that seeing that you are able to transform the experience of suffering into an experience of kindness within yourself is, I guess, transformative within yourself. And the way you phrased your instruction sounded like, you know, you said letting go of the, you know, the positive attributes of those, the worldly winds, those pairs. So for me, letting go sounded a lot like not clinging to it. Is that what you had in mind? So rather than actually sort of, you know, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, sort of basking in the good feeling that I can transform suffering into something positive, actually you're not even holding on to that transformative experience. You're really learning to be okay with totally letting go of the attributes that you would like to experience.
That's
Is that right?
That's exactly it. You're breathing it in, and because you're holding it in kindness and tenderness and friendliness, you can transform it, that pain. But we are not keeping it, so we are letting it go. We're letting the pleasure that comes with that, we're letting it go. And then we bring it right back, breathe it right back in, all the difficulty, and then transform it, and then letting it go. And that's this way of helping us see the worldly winds as just normal stuff and continuous. They don't ever stop. Good. Thanks. Katie.
Yeah, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about how to support other people who are going through a loss. I have a really good friend, and her best friend was recently diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and she's only 28 years old, and I've been trying to, you know, hold space for my friend. But I feel I notice myself being really careful about how I talk to her, because, you know, she doesn't have this kind of practice. She's not Buddhist, and that's fine. But I feel like if I were to say, like, well, it's just nature, this is going to happen to everyone,
permanent,
like, it would not go over well. But I want to like provide some kind of space or comfort, or bring, you know, a huge point of my practice to me is to be able to like bring wisdom without trying to get people to become Buddhist or something like that. But I don't know. Do you have any advice on
how I think it's just in your practice itself. So in your practice, if you be with her and you let her just be however it is, because you know, this is impermanent, and this is grief connected to loss. This is not her. This is not intentionally pointed at you. So if she happens to be in a flippant mood, or if she happens to be in a sad mood, whatever that mood is, whatever that way she's being, you just allow it to be. That it's not personal. It's not about you, and it's not about her. It's about coming to terms with loss and impermanence, and that is difficult for us to bear. That's what you're really coming to terms with. You see? So your practice is really to help you remember to allow her to be however she is. Mm-hmm. And she will ask you, Katie, how come you're so steady? How come you just, you're good with me? I feel comfortable being myself around you. Then you could say, well, you know, I do a little meditation. Helps me get steady. But the main point is to just use your practice to help you see the truth of how it is right now. And this is what it's like when we're going through grief. It's not personal.
Really helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clay.
Hey, Tora. So was one, I find it a lot easier to think about loss and grief of like, and death of other people because yes. I'm there to experience it and we've all kind of know what it's like and lost someone at least at a certain point. But when I think about my own death and then just not existing for trillions of years after that, my head kind of goes for a spin.
That's right.
So I'm curious how you think about that.
That's why we are going to look at the death contemplation separate, because it's a completely separate kind of thing. But in the real sense, I don't think it's so much about our demise as much as it is learning to deal with loss and separation. Loss and impermanence is much more of what the human death brings us. It's the end of something. And we're learning to come to terms with the end of things. The letting go of the end of things that we cannot prevent that end from coming. And that's more of what I think these types of death practices are more about, allowing us to begin to see the end of things, that things change. So even if I don't connect to the, I'm of the nature to get old and I'm of the nature to die, the fourth one is everything that's dear to me will vanish and change. And nothing and no one can change that either. So there's a way of, that's a little bit more cutting, even if I can't get to the death of things. So the point of the death contemplations we're going to talk about next week is more towards learning to grapple with the reality that we're going to die. And it is, and Venerable Nalio points exactly to that feeling of, I just don't feel my own demise. I don't seem to connect with that. And he talks about that. And so we'll talk a little bit about that next week. But that's what I think we're pointing to. It's more around impermanence and loss. That's more real in your life. That's up close and personal. And that is the same as the death contemplation. It's coming to terms with the reality that life conditions change and our lives are affected by it, and there's nothing we can do about it. That it's not personal. Do you see the difference?
I think so.
Yeah,
thank you.
We'll look next week at the actual death contemplation and see if there's, it may be that it just doesn't connect with you. It begins to connect the older you get, but some people are young and they're around a lot of family members who have died, and then you can connect with it. So it just depends on where you're at in that place, but we'll practice with it, and if it doesn't resonate, don't worry about it. Dealing with loss and impermanence, that's going to hit home just as easy as the death contemplation of the human body.
Thank you.
Good. Yes, Steve.
I'm going to ask the same question that I've asked before about self. Because I think grief is related to responsibility or being attached to outcomes that I have responsibility for or authority over. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to say this. I think it's related to, I don't have anything to do with self. I don't have anything to do with the decisions I make. They're habit. And I think that's what you're pointing to when you say that it's the practice that you do beforehand that gives you the decisions in the moment that you have responsibility for, that you can't have grief over because it doesn't turn out well.
Right, because wisdom kicks in. You can see this is an ending. I knew this was an ending for them, but they seem to get caught up in the ending like it's somebody's fault. But it's not anybody's fault, you see? So it's, I can see that, but I've been practicing with impermanence and loss for a while. I guess what I'm trying to say is the thing you're pointing to is you're getting trapped in the notion of non-self. So there's no me doing things. And somehow or another, we think we can understand what non-self is. But it's like riding a bike. I can tell you all day what balance is. But until you actually get on the bike and figure out how to maneuver without falling down, it's not going to make any sense. So I can tell you about swimming, but until you actually float in the water, it's not going to make any sense. You have to feel the sense of floating or feel the sense of balance to begin to understand what that is. And that felt sense of balance or floating is not something you just solidly get. It's something you begin to feel into and come to an understanding of what it is. So likewise, when the Buddha was pointing to non-self, if you try to understand it from the words, it won't make any sense. Because of course there's a self here. Of course I'm the one that's doing something. Of course I'm the one that's yelling at Thaddeus or whatever I'm doing or getting all in a tizzy. There's somebody, something doing that. But the beginning to feel into what is habit and what is present moment awareness of here and now is very different. And when we are in habit, we are doing things without really being connected with what we're doing because we're really trying to fix the problem. That's why they were arguing with each other, because both of them are trying to somehow or another fix this loss, and they're blaming the other person for why it's there, as if somehow or another, you're not doing enough. No, you're not doing enough. No, it's you. No, it's you. And Dhamma, when you start practicing with the understandings of these concepts, you can begin to realize and see, like having greater wisdom. So you're not so, it's sort of like I always use this example. It's like those pictures that are made up, one big picture is made up of a whole bunch of tiny pictures. If you get up close, it doesn't make any sense. There are all these random little pictures and they don't even make any sense of what are you trying to say? But when you move back and you see the randomness from a wider scope, then you can begin to understand, oh, I see what you're doing. I see what that's a picture. that's a lady, or that's a man, or that's a being, or whatever. That's a house. I can see it. Because you're just using the colors. It's not really each of those little pictures. So likewise, when you start thinking about grief, if you tie the loss to you, then there is a sense that there's something you should have done, something I should have been, some way I should have kept this from happening. And if I were a better person, I wouldn't have this loss. That's what the grasping mind thinks. It thinks it can control everything. But when you begin to practice with the normalcy and the randomness and the conditional nature of impermanence and loss, then you can begin to see, I don't have to respond out of habit. I can just respond with the present moment. So there could be sadness, there could be anger, there could be all those emotions, but you don't have to take it out on someone else. It's not their fault. It's not my fault. You can, it's still uncomfortable and it's still painful, but you have more, I think, more fortitude to say, this is difficult. I'm having a really hard time right now. It probably isn't the best time for us to talk about this. Or I'll go do this and you do that. I mean, you have more capacity to speak truth to the moment. That's what you're looking for. And if you do lose it on someone, you kind of know, I just lost it on someone. So going back and making amends and saying I'm sorry is not this kind of, I'm always the one that says I'm sorry. Well, I wouldn't have yelled at them if they hadn't done this. You don't get caught up in all that. You just can speak the truth of the way things were. Do you see?
And not get caught up if the person's not around to say I'm sorry to anymore.
That's right. You can't get caught up in that. Because even if they're not around, the I'm sorry isn't really for them. The I'm sorry is more for you. For you to come to terms with making amends with your own missteps. So we can see our own missteps and come to terms with the truth of that. And that creates wholeness. It creates cohesion and authenticity in ourselves. So if it was just about saying I'm sorry to somebody else, we have to depend on them to accept our apology. And that they may not do. So it has to be, I'm coming in alignment with my own grief because I am prepared to accept who I am, how I've been, what I've done. And I'm actually, you're forgiving yourself. You see? Good. Well, I guess we gotta go. I don't remember getting an email, I think, of somebody who's gonna do announcements. Do you know, Ken, if there's announcements? Cheryl? Oh, wait. Cheryl, aren't you the announcement person?
Yeah, well, I did them last week and I'm doing them next week.
Okay.
I'm just not there. Yeah, I'm confused too, but yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's usually on first and third. That's when we do them. The talk nights. All right, good. Well, we did them already. So now, last Monday, 31st, we're going to have a ceremony. Not quite sure what the ceremony is going to look like, but, you know, I do love ceremony. So there will be ceremony. I'm telling you up front. It's going to be ceremony around the loss of people we care about. So I also want you to be prepared for that grief that we're going to practice with. And we'll talk a little bit more pointedly about grief and how to hold it and things like that. All right. So I just want you to be prepared for that on Sunday, Monday, even though I'm not quite sure what what we're going to do. I'm still working on it. All right. So is there anything else anybody want to say? Are we good? So we're going to practice a little bit with these. Oh, I know somebody sent me a text. Somebody sent a chat. You can go to Damagiri, but let me see if I can put this, I pulled it up myself, and let me see if I can, let's see, how can I do this? I don't actually have it as a link. But you can go to Damagiri's website. I have a few minutes. I can grab it right quick. Give me 1 second. All right. This won't take but a second. Put this link here. It's actually Sacred Mountain Sangha, which is part of Damagiri, but here's where you can find all their chants. All right. So you look at the chants and then find one that you really like that resonates with you. And then find some Dhamma principle and say it along with the chant. Say it along with the chant. Say it along with the chant so that the two begin to infuse each other and it begins to infuse your practice. I just think we have to, I really believe that we need to bring some kind of uplift to practice, which is more of what we're going to talk about with devotion and rituals. But there's something about rituals and devotion that bring uplift. And in this insight tradition, we're not very devotional. I mean, we are devotional as practitioners, but there's not this open devotion like there is in other Buddhist practices. And I think it's because many of the practitioners of insight are not Buddhist. So there's this thought that if we're doing the devotional, we got to be Buddhist. But I'm hoping I can help us see and bring in some devotional aspects that are not connected to Buddhism and are more connected to how to have your practice be alive and engaging. All right? But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Next week, I'm going to just do a summary and talk about the death meditation. I'll be here. I'm not going over to their house at all. All right. So see you next week. Thank you so much for your kind attention, your practice. Try it out. Practice a little bit with these things. Just try it out and see what you think.